It's been 2 weeks now since Adrian Diaz took over as Seattle's police chief. This follows the abrupt retirement of Carmen Best and months of tension over those protests, over racial justice, and over police brutality. Chi Radio's Hannah Scott got a chance to sit down with the new chief yesterday and talk one-on-one. So tell us about it, Hannah.
So, yeah, I sat down with the chief for about 13 minutes total, I think, is the time I got. And he comes into the job feeling very optimistic and ready for the challenge.
When you're talking about change, you know, sometimes it's about the right timing. And I think this is the right time. There's a lot of discussion in our community about what policing needs to look like in their community. And so this is the right timing for those discussions. And I'm always willing to sit down with people and then also talk about my perspective as a police officer, but also my perspective as a person of color as well. And so I think this is when you want to lead. You want to lead in the most challenging times because that's where you're going to see the best change.
Now, as soon as he took over, Chief Diaz quickly announced plans to shift 100 officers to patrol, and he was really excited that that's on track to be completely in place by the end of the month.
I was faced with a very quick decision early on in my tenure, and I was willing to make it, and the mayor, you know, supported me on that decision. So, you know, I think, honestly, that I'm very fortunate to have that support. I have to run this department because we're dealing with challenging times, and I can't just rest on what we've done in the past. I've got to figure out how we're actually going to problem solve and move this department forward.
We also talked about his overall vision of policing in Seattle.
It's a major city. It's 780,000 people. We have, you know, big city problems. We have homicides. We have robberies. We have rapes. We have all sorts of crime that does occur. You do have to have a variety of community partnerships, but you do have to have police. Right now, our focus is making sure that we have adequate police staffing, address those real big issues. And then there's areas of policing that I would love to have discussions about what community organizations can take some of that work. When it comes to like mental health and homelessness, there hasn't been a chief in my time, at least over the last 10 years, that has said we can't arrest our way out of these issues. And so those are the deeper discussions that I want to have with people about what that looks like.
And so one thing he has already had that we didn't see Chief Carmen Best get is a seat at the table. He's talked to the city council multiple times. And as we know, when there was budget discussions about defunding police, Carmen Best wasn't at the table with the city council. And that was one of the big points of tension there. So he's excited and says he's having good relationships with the council and also feels like the mayor has his back. As far as what else he thinks needs to be done in policing is he says it needs to include addressing youth violence in communities of color.
How can we support youth growing up through a variety of different issues that they're facing and the trauma that they're experiencing? When I look at communities in the South Precinct area where, you know, shots fired are disproportionately more in that community than in other communities, and the trauma that many of those kids face, you know, those are the areas of, like, how do we invest in those families and in the youth to be able to not have to deal with that trauma every single day? How do we also create closure so that people aren't shooting up the city?
So those are kind of the things that we've heard about already being discussed both at the King County level and at the City of Seattle level, where we're maybe investing more in programs like Choose 180, mentorship programs, diversion programs, so you don't see that retaliatory gang-type violence going on or shootings going on in some of these communities. But he says that also has to include addressing adults in those communities who break the law.
I personally have always been extremely supportive of those investments into, you know, reintegration into the community because that's when you talk about somebody that's an adult that has, you know, come back into the gang life. A part of that is they've found some level of incarceration and they've lost any hope to be able to step out of that gang life because they don't have access to housing. They don't have access to, you know, some medical care. They don't have access to jobs because of their record. And so I've been a big proponent in making sure that people have options as they reintegrate in the community. But also an idea of when you've actually harmed the community, and I've got to also be able to take you out of the community. And if that means incarceration, then that means incarceration.
Now, overall, I asked him what the last several months have been like on morale, and he admits it's been tough.
You know, it's a challenging time. You know, we had first the pandemic, and then you have the demonstrations starting, and then we have riot situations. You lost a precinct, we gained a precinct. We had Chaz, we had CHOP, we had, you know, so there has gone so much in officers' lives, and so that took a big hit for morale.
And it's something he hopes to work, to change. He says this shift to 100 patrol positions is going to make a difference. He said before there were officers who weren't even able to take days off during all of those kind of things going on, the protests, the pandemic, and everything that was going on. They were so shorthanded that they couldn't have days off, and that was taking a toll as well. So he's hopeful this will make a little bit of a difference.
But he's talking about actually putting more cops on patrol, where I thought the demands of the demonstrators was to... that part of the defunding was to take cops off the streets and substitute some sort of community agency.
Yeah, my sense is that there's going to have to be kind of a starting over point as far as discussions like that go. They're going to, that's the things you're talking about are what we saw at the Seattle City Council level with communities or groups like King County Equity Now and Decriminalize Seattle. And I think at this point, when they start moving ahead with the next budget process, and they're going to have to start from the ground up and figure out what this is going to look like with a variety of new voices involved, including Chief Diaz, and they're going to have to do this compromise like we saw with the council and with the mayor. It may very well end up being that something to that degree, and he's very much on board with the idea of something that Andrew Lewis is proposing, which is that program where we have maybe first responders, not with guns, but first responders with medical training or social working, who do respond to certain calls when we talk about mental health or homelessness. He's absolutely on board with that. You know, he says not one chief that he can remember has ever said that they want to be the ones addressing mental health issues. So they just have to figure out how to do that.
Right. There's also apparently a divide between Black Lives Matter and the community itself on the level of policing. Is that correct?
There is some divide between those groups I just mentioned that were kind of working with the council and the Black Lives Matter Seattle King County group. They have now come out. They've asked for some investigation into the city council members and how they, some of them acted during the original part of the protests. They also came out and asked for the Office of Inspector General to look into a variety of things involving the police response to protests yesterday. They made that call. There's also kind of some compromise. I saw Nikita Oliver saying the day before, responding in a positive way to some of the things that the King County executive had put out there as far as in reforming policing with the sheriff's department and investing in communities. So there seems to be some middle ground, but there's still, I think, some divide on, there's a group that wants to abolish police, and I don't think they're going to get that. So I think you're seeing everybody figuring out that they're going to have to compromise.
Well, it's interesting to hear the chief in your interview there saying, basically acknowledging that the system itself sometimes keeps people in the gang life by closing the door on any sort of job prospects. So he wants to address that, while at the same time acknowledging that those who are in the gang life, for whatever reason, need to be taken out of the community so they don't hurt people.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and when he's worked a lot with youth in these types of communities, and he's very passionate about making sure that, as is everyone in this discussion at this point, making sure that they have a different path, that they don't get sucked into this. And to do that, you've got to make sure that you don't have these lifelong gang members in these communities who are allowed to continue to do what it is that they do and lure these young people in. But also, in order to get those adults out, you have to give them opportunity. And that is one of the big pushes that you've heard from everyone who's in any community of color asking for these changes. So it's good that he's on board with that, and I think that you'll see some investment in that. The big question will be, what does our economy look like here? How much investment can be made, and what effect will that have on the investments?
So there's agreement on that. There's agreement that you have to address the people who are dying in those areas, not at the hands of the police, but at the hands of these other guys, as well as addressing the improper use of police force.
Yes, there's agreement on that, but I don't know that you'd get agreement on that you should definitely, you know, lock those up who are adults in the community breaking that law. What you would get from some is these people are acting in this way because of systemic failure, systemic racism, lack of investment in these communities that have left them no choice, and being in this, you know, criminal justice system that has created them and made them this way. So you'd see the people asking for just opportunity for those folks. Not necessarily lock up, but then I think on the other side, there are those who, as you heard the chief say, you got to lock them up if they're not going to do what they need to do.
Car Raiders, Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
And now here he is, as he is every Friday, to teach us something about the history and culture of Washington State, a feature that Felix Bunnell calls All Over the Map. This week it's time for the second installment of our 13-part series. 13 parts?
That's hubris, I think. You think I'll still be here 12 episodes from now.
13-part series on the origin stories of each of Washington's 39 counties.
Yeah, so for the debut a month ago, we talked about Adams, Assotin, and Benton, and we're going to continue our alphabetical journey. First up is Chelan County in north-central Washington, created by the legislature back on March 13th, 1899. It was supposed to be called Wenatchee County, but somehow some shenanigans got it switched at the last minute. Now, that name Chelan derives from a native word, first put to paper by Alexander Ross, maybe one of your ancestors, Dave?
I think they'd be called Chelanigans, wouldn't they? No relation.
Okay. Well, that was around 1810 when Ross wrote about his experiences in that area and the people and the geography he ran into. He was a trapper based down in Astoria. Now, Ross spelled it differently with a T-S and an I, so it looked like Tsilane or Tsilan on the page. The meaning is not especially clear. It could be deep water or land of bubbling water. It'd be nice if it was the land of bubbling water county. That would be much more descriptive.
Yes.
County seat's Wenatchee, also a native word. Spelled many different ways. First appears in print from Lewis and Clark, but, you know, they spelled every word differently on depending on the page, if you ever looked at their old journals. If the meaning is thought to be river issuing from a canyon. Next up is Clallam County on the Olympic Peninsula, also a native term, thought to mean strong people or brave people. The county seat there, Port Angeles, had a much longer name. It was first called Puerto de Nuestra Señora de los Ángeles, or Port of Our Lady of the Angels for Mary, the Mother of God. Name kept getting shortened. Another Spanish explorer in 1792 just made it Puerto de los Angeles. And then George Vancouver just called it Port Angeles. Taking it a step further, I know people who grew up there who just called the place PA.
PA.
And it got named about 10 years after Los Angeles in California got named that way. So it's kind of second place. Now, finally, Clark County in southwest Washington is named for the Corps of Discovery explorer William Clark. It was first organized by the provisional government back in 1844 and when it was part of the Vancouver District, and that place was huge. The boundary was the Columbia River on the south, 5440 on the north, Pacific on the west, Rockies on the east. That place was huge. It got shortened and made smaller when they settled the international boundary in 1846. And then the county seat is Vancouver, which, of course, is named for, say it with me, Captain Vancouver. So
yes.
It's a good mix of Spanish, British, and native names in these three counties in this episode of our county series.
I'm curious, is any other county in Washington besides King changed the reason for calling it what it's called?
As far as I know, that's the only one. And you're jumping ahead, though, because in the next episode, we're going to look at Columbia, Cowlitz, and Douglas. That's my deep promo for this episode of All of
Them. I can't wait. I'm in suspense now. Our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Abe.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Chris Sullivan and Colleen O'Brien. Sometimes I think this job has become sort of the play-by-play of the apocalypse. There's something new every day. And most of us didn't suffer directly from the wildfires, but we've heard the stories of those who have. We've seen the pictures. And it creates this unsettled feeling. And it has a word, solastalgia, coined by this man, Professor Glenn Albrecht, who is attached to the School of Geosciences at the University of Sydney. And you've had your share of wildfires in Australia there, haven't you?
So, yes, unfortunately, we share a common experience, and many of our folk are going through a full range of emotions and feelings with respect to the impact of fire. And the term solastalgia is one that I coined in 2003 to describe what happens to people's psychological states and their emotions when an environment that they love suddenly is transformed or changed in ways that they find distressing and negative. And so solastalgia is the loss of solace or comfort from your relationship to your home environment. And it's similar to the concept of nostalgia, which most people are familiar with, where the traditional definition of nostalgia was a type of homesickness or melancholia that people would feel when they were absent from home and wished to return.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cure for nostalgia was just simply to go home. Well, solastalgia, in a sense, is the opposite. You stay home, but your home goes away. So under the impact of mining, wildfire, climate change, and a whole range of other transformative factors that can shift an environment from one that you feel comfortable with, that your relationship is stable and good and solid, to one that suddenly becomes one of anxiety, one of unease, yeah, one of distress. And I call it solastalgia.
Well, let me ask you then, the fact that you thought that this phenomenon was significant enough to coin a new word to describe it, is this something that should be accounted for by those who are responsible for either making these changes or letting them happen?
Well, yes, I think we're gradually seeing this in Australia, that the impact assessment of things like major construction projects, mining companies are being forced to consider solastalgia. So solastalgia has actually gone to court. Right from the beginning of my use of this term, I've seen it as a way of addressing the causes of the distress. It's never been a neutral term, and I, being a philosopher, I don't work in a psychiatric or psychological way. I'm not trying to diagnose a new illness. There's nothing about solastalgia that's connected to, you know, a form of extreme mental illness. It's actually a reasonable response to an unreasonable attack on your sense of place. And so as a result, the solution to the problem of solastalgia is to address its causes. Now, in the case of mining, it's fairly obvious to mitigate the impacts of mining or to prevent it in the first place. Other issues like the causes of wildfire are much more complex, but included in that are obviously things like climate change and the way that humans are interacting with areas that are capable of burning. You know, this sense of love of place is profound, and to have it disturbed, to have it destroyed, and to see that this will only get worse in the future unless we change, will be the subject of the famous Chinese saying that if we don't change soon, we'll get where we're going.
The Chinese are always good at coming up with proverbs that are terrifying.
Yeah.
Professor Glenn Albrecht is with the School of Geosciences at the University of Sydney and coined the term solastalgia, which may explain what a lot of us are feeling. And thank you for coming on with me. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. And I hope that the fires are extinguished by good rains and that people can begin to rebuild.
Who decides who gets the vaccine first? The FDA, the CDC, and other medical experts say it'll be the first responders and the most at-risk Americans who get it first. We called up CBS's Margaret Brennan, who hosts Face the Nation, because it sounds like the president might be getting ready to release it to everyone.
Well, what you're talking about is an emergency use authorization, which would sort of skip through the FDA process a little faster. It's higher risk when that happens. The FDA scientists would have to make that declaration on their own. And as we've seen, remember when the president was pushing hydroxychloroquine, the FDA didn't bend on that. In fact, they were saying hydroxychloroquine they were concerned about and issuing, after issuing an emergency authorization, then pulled it back saying, don't do this. So we've kind of seen a test case for the scenario in some way you're talking about, which is that the career scientists will push back on it when they have data. Really, what's driving this is the science itself. And Pfizer, again, even in that best case scenario, they say there's a 60% chance they'll know the effectiveness by next month.
Okay,
60% chance.
But so this is a matter of law then, that the FDA calls the shots, and regardless on whether the president wants to speed it up or not, he does not have the authority to overrule the FDA, and William Barr would go along with that?
I mean, in terms of can people try to rewrite the law, and would the Justice Department be complicit in doing that? I in those hypotheticals, I'm not willing to say anything is off the table, particularly in 2020. But from what the protocols are, and this is so key, because, look, our system doesn't work unless there is trusting of the institutions. The entire reason we have the FDA is to judge whether something's safe or not. So this is a really slippery slope. If you start making exceptions on one thing, then why would anyone trust the FDA on a million other things? So there's real pushback, and you saw that in that op-ed from FDA scientists just a week ago saying they will not bend to political pressure. That doesn't mean there won't be it. There clearly is right now. But that idea of having by November 3rd hundreds of thousands of doses of a vaccine in ready to be shot into people's arms, just practically doesn't seem to work. It's kind of a false deadline. But we could see some really positive press releases and some really positive news around that time saying, oh, we're there. But expectation-wise, you and I just aren't going to have access to it.
Okay. There was a story also that officials with Health and Human Services actually overruled the CDC on vaccine advice. So what was the advice that was overruled?
This is kind of another one of these really messy autopsies that we're seeing performed here to figure out why a few weeks ago there was this really confusing guidance that showed up on the CDC website in regard to, in particular, testing. And if asymptomatic people or people who've had contact with someone who later tested positive should receive a test or not. And from what we're now learning, it's that there were political appointees in Health and Human Services who were redrafting guidance that the CDC had originally written using language they preferred and dropping that into the CDC website so that you and I, when we're looking for what the CDC says, are actually looking at something written by someone outside that health agency. And that the accusation here is that it was being done to fit the narrative of reducing testing for, you know, political means. Yeah, I've also heard those defending it, which is to say this was to remove the burden from those who felt like they were being required by employers to be tested before reentering the workplace. The bottom line here is that we are so hurting ourselves as a country right now by undermining these institutions that truly need to be trusted in a national security and health crisis like we're in right now. So that's why these things matter. And we'll talk about that on Sunday. We have the National Security Advisor to the President. We have the former Homeland Security Advisor from the Obama administration and Dr. Scott Gottlieb as well. And the CEO of LabCorp, which is one of the companies processing these tests. And we want to know, how are we positioned going into the fall? Because testing is so key to just knowing where this virus is.
Margaret Brennan, the host of Face the Nation. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Dr. Keith Jerome, the head of the UW Virology Department. The big question parents have, is sports ever going to be back to normal? And kids, how much danger is there to kids? What is the latest on that?
Well, you know, the sports, I've got a kid in high school who's just dying about the sports, and that's an important part of life, and everybody gets that. And it's so difficult and it's so hard. You know, we all think as parents at times you kind of have to tell your kids you can't have this thing you want right now. That's a part of parenting sometimes, and that's sort of where I think we are almost as a society. We know that kids are at risk, and you know, I'm not sure that anything's really changed there that much, Dave, and we understand that children less frequently get symptomatic disease, and kind of the younger they are, the less likely they are to get symptomatic disease. Young people, even young adults, generally tolerate the infection well, but they also can get infected a lot, and they shed as much virus as anybody else. So they're as infectious as anybody else, which means even if they personally don't get sick, they can pass the infection forward. And especially here in Western Washington, we've made some really good progress in the last few weeks in terms of driving down the number of cases and the percentage of tests that are positive. And so we want to really keep that momentum. Getting infected is sort of a numbers game. Who are you close to? How much virus are they shedding? And how long were you close to them? It just sort of one viral particle isn't going to infect you, and 10 probably won't infect you, and 100 probably won't, but 1,000 or 10,000 or 1,000,000, your risk starts to get pretty high. And that's why you see these so-called super spreader events, because it turns out people got packed together, maybe they weren't being careful, and then they had the bad luck that somebody comes in and they're shedding a ton of virus. Everybody's locked in there for hours singing or yelling or whatever, and that's where you get all these transmissions.
Now that gets me to contact tracing, which is pretty important, but we just saw a report that it appears to be failing for a very human reason. People don't want to snitch on each other. They don't want to say who they've been near for fear that they would prompt a call from the state. So, what do you do about that?
Yeah, Well, I've read about that too, Dave. You know, I think one thing that I'll disagree with a little is to say that it's failing. I think that it's not working as well as we wish it were, and it needs to be improved, and hopefully there are efforts to improve it. But I do want people to understand that all these precautions we're taking this virus, whether it's contact tracing, it's a mask, it's a vaccine, they're not success or failure. They're not black and white. They're not yes, no. That everything is just trying to reduce the transmission a little bit. Like, we get masks aren't perfect. Sometimes people argue it's masks because, hey, I saw somebody touch their mask, therefore masks are worthless. That's not true. Sure, you shouldn't be fiddling with your mask with your hands, but wearing them is reducing the transmission, and we know that. There's a lot of data. The vaccines probably won't be perfect, frankly. Like a flu vaccine in a typical year might reduce your risk by 60 or 70% of getting the flu. They're not perfect, and everybody's heard about somebody who got the flu shot and got the flu anyway. I mean, this is the reality. And so I think it's the same way with contact tracing. Yeah, it's not even close to perfect right now, but it's still helping, and we got to make it better so that it helps more.
Now I would like you to settle the debate over herd immunity. I don't know if you saw Rachel. I don't know if you saw Rachel Maddow's show, but she did a calculation. Well, so first of all, there is apparently a belief among some people that the president, when he talks about herd immunity, is serious about letting herd immunity play out. In other words, let's try to infect as many people as possible. This is why he's holding the rallies, allegedly, so that everybody gets like a little dose of virus, and that will create herd immunity. Anyway, the calculation Rachel Maddow did was that based on the idea that we infect everybody in America, if you then multiply that by the death rate from infections, herd immunity would have to kill 6 million people to work. Is this correct?
Well, I think everybody's making some calculation of that. Is it 6 million? That might be more toward the upper range of what I think might happen, but it could easily be millions of people, whether it's 2 million or 3 million. What a catastrophe that would be. If one out of every 100 Americans dies of this, that would be an unprecedented disaster for this country. So that's not a possible way to go forward, actually. And, you know, why would we do that now when we've got multiple billions of dollars worth of vaccine effort going and actually going well? And if we can just hang on for a few more months, we're going to know whether these vaccines work. And then the finish line to some degree is going to be in sight. And yeah, maybe we don't get a semblance of truly normal life back until next summer, but why in the world would we just throw up our hands and say, oh, well, I guess we'll just let 3 million people die or 6 million people die? I just frankly don't get it.
Yeah, it does seem like a bad alternative. So, and I ask you this every time, so I'm going to ask you again. Have we learned enough to do better next time?
Yeah, well, I think there was something of a perfect storm here, I think, in the virus and the way that it came out. And, you know, as the saying goes, mistakes were made. I think even by default, you know, this idea of regression to the mean, even if you just go back to average, sometimes it's an improvement. And mm-hmm. So there's probably that, frankly. But the scientific enterprise, sure. I mean, wow. The capacity that the country has built for testing, it'll be ready to go much, much more quickly than before. But it doesn't mean that it'll be instant next time. And it doesn't mean that we don't get even more unlucky next time. And remember, as terrible as this is, the one bit of good news we got out of this whole thing was that the case fatality rate, and that is just the percentage of people who die of the virus, is pretty low. I mean, it's way worse than flu or something, but it's not like the stuff that generally people have made movies about, mm-hmm. or Ebola or whatever. But that's not impossible that could happen. And we can't get to this situation with a virus that's highly lethal.
Dr. Keith Jerome, director of the University of Washington Virology Lab. Dr. Jerome, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure, Dave. Take care.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness now brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. Fire crews in East Pierce County got some unexpected help last weekend from a 16-year-old boy. Cairo Radio's Miley Katie has his story.
The Sumner Grade Fire burned through nearly 500 acres and destroyed two homes. Camden, a volunteer fire cadet, wanted to show his appreciation for the men and women risking their lives to tame the blaze.
Being hydrated is a pretty key thing. Working around heat and working in the heat, you can get dehydrated pretty quick, and especially working on steep hillsides. And when you're sweating a lot, you need a lot of water to drink.
He dipped into savings from summer jobs like bucking hay and mowing lawns to buy supplies. And he showed up to the command post with water bottles and Gatorade. Fire Chief Bud Backer says crews had been turning people away who'd offered to donate because they already had everything they needed.
But Camden, being a 16-year-old young man, spending the money he makes mowing lawns during the summer on this, the desire in this young man to give back was just something we couldn't just, turn back.
Camden didn't want to stop there. He asked firefighters what else he could do.
The next day after he was talking to some folks here, they said, well, we might be a little light on hand sanitizer. So he brought a bunch of hand sanitizer. And again, we've got it around. It was just, something somebody was trying to think of, well, what can we tell this young man, something that we could use that, would let him feel like he's helping out.
In all, Camden says he spent around $180 on supplies. On Sunday, firefighters asked Camden to come back to the command post and meet Chief Backer so he could extend a personal thank you.
I presented him with a chief's coin. It follows the military tradition of commanders handing out coins as a thank you and recognition of a job well done. So we presented him with one of those coins. He was pretty happy to get that.
Camden tells us the coin is already very special to him.
Means a lot because on the four things it says on it, on the outside of it, are dedication, service, integrity, and leadership.
Camden says he plans on using these qualities to become a firefighter one day. The chief says he thinks he's got what it takes.
He's on the right path in that, and we've told him, hey, when all this quiets down, come by and talk to us about your future.
That is Miley Katie reporting. I feel like anytime somebody wants to rail on the youths, I'll just point them to the countless stories I've done of young people being better than any of us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, he's got the warm-up hoodie. He's got the hat. He's got the Ohio State logo. Hey. He's got the beads. Are the beads part of the swag?
The beads? Yeah.
I don't know about the beads.
You don't know about the beads?
Those are Buckeyes, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're like wooden beads.
Yeah, I like beads.
Nice. I hadn't thought about accessorizing in that way, but I might.
You're the only guy, maybe here in the studio, I won't say all guys, who can pull off that necklace.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Would you call it a necklace?
I don't know what it is. It just looks good.
What are Buckeye bees? Beads.
A Buckeye is a nut. And so they kind of look like that. Those beads are also very...
Well, I thought this was sports related, like the Buckeyes.
It is. That's what they're named after.
Oh, I'm so lost.
It's also very popular in Polynesian and Samoan culture.
Hey, we only got a little bit of time. But real quick, before you start asking me questions.
Yes, what?
Brother.
Yeah.
Your voice and that beard is the best.
Yeah. You like that, huh?
You just got like a Teddy Pendergrass vibe to you, fam.
So I finally look like the voice is what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yes! Mm-hmm. That's it! That is it! And so from here on out, you cannot shave the beard.
That's true. There's no physical way to do it anymore. It's now gone beyond the capacity of any commercially sold clipper.
It's true. I don't know how you could buzz through that thick mock you've got. The what did you call it? Beard vest in your commentary? I took a picture of it a couple days ago, and it was nice and floofy. I'm going to post that picture on Twitter.
So can we talk about, what is it, Sunday night? Is that what they're playing?
Sunday night is going down, the Patriots against the Seahawks. Sunday night football, Cam Newton against Russell Wilson. Pete Carroll against Bill Belichick. It's here. 2020, this is something that we need. And I want to talk about the fact that I think the Seahawks right now, like before the first game of the season, we're going into it and everybody's like, oh, what do you think the Seahawks are going to look like? And I'm like, well, we're going to see. They haven't had OTAs. They haven't had mini camp. It was kind of a weird training camp, if you will, the postponement, the delay. Oh, my goodness. I thought the Seahawks looked phenomenal.
Yeah.
I thought Russell Wilson played. I've talked to Russell Wilson's former teammates, former players that have said that is the best they have ever seen Russell play first game out of the season.
Now, that's because he's been unleashed. He's allowed to play fourth quarter football in the first quarter.
that could be it, right? I was going through, and I was talking to someone last night, and we were talking about Russell Wilson's first game down in Arizona in 2012. Russell Wilson threw 16 passes in his first game. He went 12 for 16. They lost that game, right? And just to let you know, and then here he is now, he throws nearly, well, I think he throws 39 passes in this game. Yesterday, last night, Joe Burrow, the quarterback for Cincinnati, threw 60 passes in his first game. So the game is changing. Yeah. And so the reason why I bring that point up is because I believe that while the game is changing, is it's now becoming more of an offensive type game, I think what we are going to see now, I think there is a potential that we are going to see an even better Russell Wilson than we've ever seen before, because he is being unleashed earlier on. Before, we used to always see him, it's like, look, I know things are rough in the first, second, and third quarter, but we have gotten so used to Russell in the fourth quarter, right?
It's like he was testing the waters, figuring out the other team, and then bam.
And then bam. And then so we, and by the way, it's almost like everybody listening right now, you know, you've seen the movie. You've seen the Seahawk movie where they've been down, and then at the very end, it's like, oh my gosh, Russell with a key save today. We are now going to see him unleashed in the first quarter.
And he's only 31 years old. With most franchise quarterbacks getting into their mid-40s before they decide to move on, we have conservatively 15 more years.
It's dynasty time.
Yeah. When does he hit his, is this sort of peak age for quarterbacks, or is he heading into his peak?
I'm glad you said that, because I actually learned a lesson last night from a former player. They were telling me, like, you can see with quarterbacks, they were saying that you can see them in the beginning, and most quarterbacks usually have their peak. Right, they usually have their peak at about year three of their career, and then they kind of get ready to fizzle out. There are people that believe that the peak for Russell Wilson is just beginning right now.
Wow,
they believe like so. These would make the great quarterbacks, right? So we're talking about Tom Brady, right? He's 43 years old. Colin, you just said it. Russell Wilson's 31.
Oh.
Russell Wilson's 31.
He could be my baby brother.
Wait a minute. But check this out, though. Russell Wilson, 31, and have you ever heard the saying, black don't crack?
Right, right. Yeah,
you know what I'm
you
saying?
Said it, but boy, it's
yeah,
true.
I said it. Yeah. but boy looks good, right? Like, Russell Wilson looks good. So if he's 31, Tom Brady's 43, and he's still good at this time, you mean to tell me
that Can we see the first 50-year-old quarterback?
You know what I'm saying? All he got to do is throw some cocoa butter on, and he's still good. Yeah. Awesome. All right, gotta get on out of here.
Yeah. G. Scott with Ursula starting at 9 right here on Cairo Radio.